to Normalize This, where we are dissecting sexual vocabulary, asking intimate questions, and starting necessary conversations. I'm your host, Kenny Francoeur, and this is Normalize This. Let's get to work. So for today's tidbit, we are going back into the annals of history. While today's physical artifact first made an appearance in ancient Greece, we don't have full record of its usage or purposes until it burst on the scene during the Jin Dynasty in China in 1200 AD. This monumental relic of world history is the cock ring, an invention as integral to modern human life as the self-cleaning oven. During the Jin Dynasty, cock rings were made out of jade, ivory, or sometimes, and I shit you not, goat eyelids. The goat eyelids created a stretchy, adjustable cock ring, much like the silicone ones available today, except the modern adjustable ones don't come complete with eyelashes. While cock rings were essentially the first form of Viagra, which we'll get to in a second, they were also used as penis adornments, which is most likely why they were also made out of desirable materials like jade and ivory. As history progressed, record of cock rings continues. During the Victorian era, they took the cock ring to a different level, designing bumps or spikes on the inside of the ring. Victorian cock rings were often used as punishment for deviant men or to try and reduce male urges by inflicting pain if the wearer got an erection. As you can only imagine, this technique was commandeered by historic BDSMers to purposely inflict some pain in pursuit of pleasure. In order to understand how a cock ring truly works, we need to understand how an erection works. Safety goggles on. There are two parts of the nervous system that can spark a wild willy. If a person hears, sees, smells, or thinks of something arousing, the limbic system of your brain sends neurosignals down to the penis. If physical touch is the impetus, whether you're getting massaged in an erogenous zone, or whether you're, you know, choking chicken or pulling pork, the peripheral nervous system sends that same signal. When those signals of arousal stimulate the shaft, and I've got to interrupt myself here, I don't think I like the word shaft because it sounds so clinical, but then when I say it, it also sounds kind of dirty, so maybe I actually love it. But when the shaft is stimulated, nitric oxide is secreted within the penis, which relaxes smooth muscle within it. The smooth muscle it's mainly relaxing is called the corpusa cavernosa. The corpusa cavernosa are two cylinders that run parallel along the length of the ding-dong. And as we all know, it doesn't matter how cavernous your cavernosa is, only if you know what to do with it. Now, when these cylinders are relaxed, the blood vessels carrying blood into the penis expand and blood fills the cylinders up. Simultaneously, the wrapping around the cylinders, the tunica albuginea, which coincidentally is the name of Gwyneth Paltrow's next child, the tunica albuginea contracts outside of the corpusa cavernosa, which restricts the blood from escaping. So, for an erection to occur, more blood has got to be clocking in than clocking out. A cock ring is an external apparatus that can accomplish a similar thing. By restricting the outer walls of the penis where the veins that carry blood out are, you can keep more blood in the shaft. So why do people refer to this as the world's first Viagra? Well, blood is always flowing in and out of the penis, even when it's flaccid and limp as a noodle. So there is the potential that, even if more blood is not flowing in when you'd like to have an erection, by constricting the vessels that carry blood out, you can begin to store more blood and hopefully achieve an erection. So there's a chance that cock rings can actually do the work for you, but cock rings are also used to enhance work that's already been done if you have no difficulty getting and sustaining an erection. Penis owners who use cock rings report having a greater sensitivity during sex due to the extra blood engorging their wee-wee, which can sometimes lead to a more substantial orgasm. Many also use cock rings so that they do not have to worry about maintaining an erection for the entire duration of their horizontal mambo. It can allow for some people to just, you know, get out of their heads a bit. Now, it is not recommended to use cock rings for more than 30 minutes. Some sources even go as far to say that there's really a 20-minute max. If you wear it too long, blood can begin to coagulate, and no one wants a schlong filled with clumpy blood. So it is also imperative that you wear a size that is constricting but not painful, because a cock ring that is too tight can do damage to your private bits. Now, there are several styles. There are stiff metal and plastic ones. There are stretchy, adjustable silicone ones. There are ones made out of leather that button or Velcro on the end for easy application and removal. There are also ones that go around the entirety of the franks and beans. There are ones that go around just the shaft. And there are ones that go around the penis and the balls separately, almost acting like a scrotal stretcher. If you are a novice, I would suggest going the silicone or leather route. These tend to be the easiest to put on and get off. A word of advice, though, using a little lube on the cock ring itself can be a lifesaver so that it goes on and comes off easily, and it reduces the risk of pulling any very sensitive hairs that might get stuck to a non-lubricated cock ring. Safety goggles off. Hey, you! Yeah, you! Are you a part of a business or organization that would like to advertise on this podcast? Well, lucky you, because we have advertising space galore. All inquiries can be sent to info@normalizethispodcast.com. That's info@normalizethispodcast.com. So today we are talking about HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus. There is so much misinformation and shame-inducing stigma being perpetuated about the virus almost constantly. So it makes the work that advocacy and healthcare groups do when it comes to HIV prevention, outreach, and HIV care all the more vital. Across the country, overall transmission rates of HIV have dropped in recent years, but in certain underserved groups, rates are continuing to rise. Now, this should force us all to reconsider how we can better serve these communities to make sure that both transmission rates drop and those living with HIV can lead the healthy lives they deserve. Here to speak on this and much more is my very special guest, Matt McCallion from the Community Healthcare Network and Prep for Pride. Thank you so much for being here, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Okay, so let's just start out. What is the Community Healthcare Network?
Sure. So Community Healthcare Network, or CHN, we're a nonprofit healthcare organization. We've been around for over 30 years, initially doing mostly just family planning, but now it's fun for the whole family. So you can come in, get primary care, therapy, dental, podiatry, nutrition, wellness, all of those things and more. And you can meet teams like mine that provide you all kinds of different support services that you might need. We help you whether or not you have health insurance, whether or not you are a citizen of the United States. Just come in, tell us what you need, and we'll find a way to get it to you.
That's amazing. Okay, and so what is Prep for Pride then? Because I know you're part of that as well.
Sure. So as part of my work at CHN, I specifically work on helping people get access to PrEP to prevent HIV. And I created this handy little Instagram page called Prep for Pride to help promote the work that we're doing around PrEP within our priority population, meaning men having sex with men.
Awesome. And so for people who do not know, what is PrEP? What does it do? How do you get it?
Sure. Oh, such a complicated topic to start with. Yes.
I'm hitting you hard right away. We're getting it out of the way.
Yes. So PrEP is a medication that you can take if you believe you might be at risk for HIV and you'd like to prevent becoming HIV positive. Really, it's for anyone who wants it. It's been around, approved by the FDA since 2012. And so if you're someone who doesn't always use condoms, or your partner's positive and you want to have a baby, or maybe you don't have multiple partners but your partner does, maybe you use recreational drugs that impact your decision sometimes, all those kinds of things could make you a good candidate for taking PrEP. The protection that you get from HIV is in your control. It's not dependent on your partner, which is different for many people than using condoms, where it's dictated by one partner in that relationship, right? And so if you're someone who's concerned about it, you can take PrEP once a day, and it's about 99% reduction of your risk of getting HIV.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so what is the difference? So there's two forms out there. Mm-hmm. And so I get a lot of questions about this. I have seen it and I question it myself. There is Truvada for PrEP and Descovy for PrEP.
Yes.
Is there a difference, and what should people know about that difference?
So this is a very political question.
Then don't answer it. Don't say anything.
Yes, there are some differences that you might want to know between Truvada and Descovy. Descovy was very recently approved to be used as PrEP for daily use only for people having anal sex. So if you're a cisgender female having vaginal sex, Descovy is not a good option for you. It won't protect you, unfortunately. The medicines that are used to make up Truvada and Descovy, one is the same and the second one is different. And with Descovy, we find that that second medicine is absorbed a little bit better in your body. And so the dosage of that medicine is lower. Because of that, we see that in some cases, there's less initial side effects when starting Descovy, and less potential for like kidney problems and bone density problems that are very rare, but can happen with Truvada. So the argument is that it's potentially a little bit safer. Now, when I say safer, we're talking like fractions of a percent.
Cool. So yes, the risk is low either way.
Yes.
But they're both out there. So if I were, as I am, if I am a gay man who is cisgendered and it's been tested on people who were assigned male at birth, mm-hmm, if I'm faced with either option, I really can pick either one that I'm comfortable with.
Yes. We don't have as much data right now on Descovy as we do on Truvada, so I would take that into account. And the data that we do have is really only research that's been done by the company making the drug. So
okay, this is a little complicated. Yeah,
this is where we get a little political, but I encourage you to talk to your doctor about it. Some things also to be aware of with Descovy: potential for weight gain, like 5 to 10 pounds.
Absolutely not. Throw it in the garbage.
And if you're someone who has a cholesterol concern, it can potentially raise your cholesterol. So other good things to know.
Okay, yeah. Right. So if I were going to my doctor, I want to get on PrEP.
Yes.
Of either kind.
Yes.
What do I have to do to get on it? Are there tests I will need to take? Is there any kind of formalities that I'll need to go through? Mm. And how often do I need to do all that stuff?
Okay, cool. So it's a pretty simple process, but for young, generally healthy people, like the majority of PrEP users, it can be a little bit burdensome because you're going to end up going to the doctor quarterly. Meaning every 3 months. So to get on PrEP initially, you'll have to do some blood work and some swabs of all your naughty places.
Who doesn't love a good swab? You know, it's what I die waiting for in the morning. I'm like, oh, can't wait for my daily swab.
So yeah, we're going to check you for HIV. We're going to check you for gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, hepatitis. And we'll have some conversations about other concerns that we might have, like how are your kidneys doing? Do you have any conditions that might interfere with your medicine? For example, like if you're someone who takes feminizing hormones like estrogen, we have seen some drug-drug interactions with PrEP and estrogen. It doesn't reduce your hormone levels. You're still good. Your hormone levels will be great, but it slightly reduces the effectiveness of Truvada for PrEP. So those are the kinds of conversations you might have. But basically, once we determine you're okay, we'll repeat those labs every 3 months to make sure you're still negative, your kidneys are still A-okay, and that you're getting treated promptly for any STIs that might come up.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. It's so funny to hear people talk about like going in for the testing associated with it. Mm-hmm. My first time, I was not tested at all. I was in Boise, Idaho, working on the road, and they just like handed it off to me. And I was grateful because it was helpful, but yes. I was like, oh, great. And then the next time they were like, okay, so we'll do your like kidney labs. And I was like, what? Oh, this is harmful. No one. But I guess like at that time, I guess in that area, perhaps too, like there just wasn't a lot of maybe education to healthcare providers, or maybe it was just someone who shouldn't be a healthcare provider, just passing out PrEP willy-nilly.
Which, like, hey, hooray for access, right? Like,
I'm very grateful for it.
But yeah, it's really important that you just don't start without at least making sure you're HIV negative and your kidneys are okay. The main thing we want to avoid is people who are positive and don't know it, taking PrEP that they got from either a doctor or someone they know, and taking it while they're positive. Because if you are positive, PrEP is not going to help treat your HIV. You need more than just the Truvada or Descovy to do that.
Do I need to have a primary care physician for any of this, or can this all be through individual healthcare organizations or through urgent cares? Like, what if I'm someone who has limited access to doctors or to insurance, what would you say to them?
Sure. So I have many patients who don't come to my clinics for primary care. They only come in for PrEP. Or some go to their primary care doctor somewhere else and come to us just for PrEP because they don't want to tell their primary care doctor they're taking it. So there's lots of ways you can go about getting your health care. I always encourage folks to get a primary care doctor because you never know when you're going to need one. And in New York, if you don't have health insurance, there are still options for you. So if you make under about $65,000 a year and you don't have insurance, or your insurance sucks and won't pay for these things, the state will pay for your medical care for PrEP and the drug company will pay for the medication. So essentially it could be free.
Mm. Is that the, like, isn't there some kind of, not rebate, but like there's a program where there's a certain amount of money that the drug provider will give out?
Totally.
That's great.
Yeah. So even if you have insurance and you're paying copays, stop paying copays immediately because you can get those covered by the drug company.
And so when we're looking at like trying to get this kind of medication and outreach out, from my own limited perspective, it feels like there are certain communities where this has been being done for years and really popularized, and then certain ones that may have been left in the fray when it comes to this. So what does the Community Healthcare Network, and what do you, and what do PrEP for Pride, what are your tactics in trying to reach out to communities where potentially HIV transmission rates are actually rising?
Yeah, I think you're really speaking to a strong issue that we see in this type of work, is that some people are getting the information and some people just aren't. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, part of the work at CHN is trying to make sure that anyone who needs care can come in and get culturally competent care and education that they need, regardless of, you know, what their circumstances are. And so that's really our driving mission, is to get people that help. But we, like you said, we continue to see some troubling trends in groups like young adults, youth, older adults, even heterosexual cisgender women, and our Black and Brown communities. The rates are either stable or in some cases rising. What we did see in the most recent data is that overall rates have gone down, but there are still disproportionate impacts happening out there. And so we try to get creative in terms of the work that we do. The challenge that we see is that the communities that have the highest rates of transmission and the highest prevalence of HIV and the lowest rates of retention in care for HIV, those are the same communities in New York City that are facing other chronic health issues like diabetes and obesity and all these other preventable diseases. And what that tells us is, you know, that these communities need more help, that the systemic problems need system-wide changes, institutionally changes. And unfortunately, healthcare in America, like many other large institutional systems in America, is slow to change.
I don't know what you're talking about, Matt. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, girl, let's put it this way. Healthcare in America relies on you having a fax machine. Like, if I can't fax a paper form, we have a problem.
And to be honest, I had to use one once for a job, and I think I broke it. I don't even know how to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's 2020, like, and the American healthcare system is just way behind where we need to be. And more broadly, you know, talking about some of these communities that are really suffering from HIV, we need some more innovative solutions. We need solutions that are going to really speak to the challenges that are being faced in these communities. You know, at the onset of HIV in the 80s, everyone was doing everything they could to learn as much as possible, right? There were places you could go, community forums and meetings and groups, to get the information and find out ways to protect yourself and the people that you care about. We've sort of reached a place now where the information is accessible to most people, But if you're not seeking it out, it hasn't been ingrained into our educational system, right? It's not something that we're routinely teaching people in a informed way. Either the information's not there or it's not accurate. And so we're leaving a lot of people out from the very beginning with giving them the proper education. And then they come into these systems where they don't have access to culturally competent resources that they need.
Mm. And so when you're talking about these like more inventive ways or more creative ways, what do you suggest, or like what are you guys doing, but what would you suggest more organizations do?
Sure. I mean, I think part of the challenge is looking at reasons why people aren't coming in for care, and addressing some of those vertical traumas and the perpetuation of stigmas that exist around HIV and STIs and sexual health in general. So there is some work that's taking place. New York City has a coalition right now that's specifically looking at stigma and resilience related to sexual health. And so my team is taking part in that coalition to take a look at what are the factors perpetuating stigma and resilience around sexual health? What is affecting the way that people seek and receive not only information, but also services? And then more broadly, like, we try to get out whenever we can to be in the community, finding people where they are. Right. So whether that be at the bar, at the club, we were at a couple like play parties recently. So if you're someone in New York who's like hosting one of those types of events, you can always reach out to my team and we'll come. We'll provide you with sex supplies, condoms, lube, whatever you really want. And we'll do on-site prep consults for people. If they have questions, they can come right up to us and ask. And it's just making the information readily available in spaces where people are already thinking about sex. That also, for many providers, includes being on those apps that some people like to use.
Oh, yes. Only Tinder.
Yes, we're on Bumble. No. Sponsored by. No. I
wish. Oh, my God.
Yeah. You know, it's been a challenge, honestly, because if you're not doing paid ads on a lot of these apps, once they identify you as an organization, they're going to ban you. So being a healthcare worker on those is a little
that's
hard.
True. You don't want like McDonald's hitting you up on Grindr for a beef patty.
Yeah, but we do our best. We offer our own version of the beef patty. We get lots of offers of
that
similar
sounds like
things.
A just delicious Urban Dictionary definition right there.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you don't mind being barraged with like dick pics. Can I say dick pics?
You can say dick pics.
Perfect.
It's only my mom listening.
Amazing. And like other photos of other body parts. It's great because you get access to people in a very intimate way where you can have private conversations with them. Although I don't know if Grindr's spying on us, but maybe. And you can give them a safe space to really talk about some of their questions and concerns and potentially get them to even come in.
Mm. So that's what like organizations can do.
Yes.
If I am not part of an organization, if I am just a person, especially if I'm a person not living in New York City, mm-hmm. who's listening in, what can I do? How can I help? Or what can I be saying or not saying when I'm talking to people, when I'm talking to my children about sex, you know, their bodies and
yes.
sexual desires?
Of course. So I think some of the easiest things to do is make sure that you yourself are educated about ways HIV is transmitted, about ways it can be prevented, and then be a good citizen by educating others. And if you live in a place other than New York where you want to help get the word out, beyond just having conversations with people about transmission, you can do a little bit of digging about what services are available where you live. There are lots of websites where like you could just Google a PrEP locator, you'll get a map, or websites like Please Prep Me, you'll get a map and you can just put in where you live and it'll give you a whole list of places that you can go to get prevention services.
Are those, so, because I at one point was using those when I was trying to get PrEP on the road or, mm-hmm. or didn't have a primary care physician and was just kind of trying to find it anywhere.
Yes.
Are those the, like when I go to that app and I look at those places, are those the only places that will provide that generally?
So those are the places that have taken the initiative to say, come to us, mm-hmm. right? So they might have special funding from their state or the federal government to help them provide that service to you. And they might be a little more adept at navigating some of your challenges with insurance or other problems. That being said, you could also just go to any doctor, and any doctor should, now I'm going to say should, be
a strong should. Yes. Yes. Not my physician in yes. Boise, Idaho, just kind of threw it at me.
Yeah. They should be informed. And if it's something that you're really serious about and you really want, I encourage you to print out that information you Googled and bring it with you to the doctor's office and say to your doctor, hey, here's this info. And that allows you to have a better informed conversation with a doctor who might not be up on the research like we are.
Mm. And so for people, I guess I've had this conversation with a lot of people talking about who, like when you think about who should be on some sort of PrEP.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a world where it's just everyone?
No. I want to say, like, I've heard this too, of like, let's just put it in the water. Let's just like make it an aerosol and spray it around.
Exactly. There's fluoride in the water for your teeth, and now there's PrEP in the water.
You know, I think not. Okay. I think there are lots of people out there who probably would never need this. But at the same time, like, it only takes once, right? It takes one encounter to become HIV positive. And unfortunately, what we know about HIV is that there are way too many people who have it and don't know they have it because they don't understand how you get it, or they don't consider themselves to be at risk, and so they're not getting tested. And then they're having sex with people who they also presume to not have it, and they're transmitting it, right? And so the most common way to get it right now is to get it from someone who didn't know they had it to begin with. And so when you say, should everyone have it? I think people should take an honest look at the sex they're having and consider it. Mm-hmm. I think everyone should consider it if they're negative, you know. But ultimately, no, I don't think it's going to be for everyone.
Okay, so if you have had sex with someone who is HIV positive or you're not sure of their status, what are your next steps here?
Sure. So this is what we consider sort of like an urgent situation. You want to either seek out your primary care doctor, or you can even in most cases walk into a local urgent care or emergency room, and they'll give you something called PEP. So that's P-E-P, unlike PrEP. So PEP is something you take after you think you were exposed, and you have to start it within 72 hours or 3 days of the sex that you had. It's a combination of medicine, and you'll take that for just about 4 weeks, and that will protect you from becoming HIV positive. Basically, it works very similar to PrEP, and by protecting certain cells, your T cells in your immune system, and it's going to prevent the HIV virus that is potentially in your body from making copies of itself. Any cells that are affected would die, and you would be continued as HIV negative from there.
Oh, that's really useful information.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here.
You're so welcome.
Oh my gosh. If you are listening, please go follow Prep for Pride on Instagram. That's the letter or the number four. God, I don't know what. The number four, said it again. So Prep for Pride on Instagram. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Welcome to the closing remarks of the episode. We made it, y'all. So make sure to follow and subscribe to this podcast and send any questions you have my way through our Instagram DMs at Normalize This. Today, I want to finish by talking about TERFs. No, I am not using an incorrect pluralization for areas of grass. But frankly, grass has more common sense than the people I'm about to discuss. Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists, or the acronym TERFs. You may have heard this term semi-recently back in December when it was used in reference to J.K. Rowling, everyone's favorite wizarding author who bestows queerdom upon characters after books have already been released and calls that representation. This all came about because of a tweet she tweeted agreeing with some detestable human being spewing offensive nonsense about traditional ideas, stupid ideas, of gender's sovereignty. TERFs maintain that trans women are not women and that they are not welcome in the feminist movement. They like to refer to themselves as gender critical, which I guess is tantamount to calling your racist grandparent old-fashioned. The term, coined in 2008 by Viv Smyth, refers to cisgendered feminists who generally oppose transgendered rights legislations. They oppose the right for trans women to exist in spaces designated for cis women, i.e. Dressing rooms or bathroom bills. And they generally just make life more difficult for trans people. Some TERFs like to claim that they are not trans-exclusionary because they'll allow for trans men to participate and share spaces with them. Ugh. These viewpoints are harmful and contribute to trans misogyny, transphobia, and also just the outdated clinging to sex essentialism, trying to cement gender in very distinct and restrictive binaries. Now, some people, mainly TERFs, are claiming that TERF is being used as a derogatory slur against them. Now, a word of advice. If you believe yourself to not be a TERF, but someone has labeled you thusly, rather than get worked up that the world is out to get you, consider why an action or saying of yours made someone feel and believe that you are a part of this group, and then adjust your behavior in the future. On the other hand, if what you believe lines up with other trans-exclusionary radical feminists, then what you were called was factual, and you should consider changing your viewpoint or simply shut it and get out of the way of others trying to obtain rights and freedoms that they deserve, rights and freedoms over which you should have no say. Replace TERF with, you know, racist, sexist, homophobic, all the phobics really, and the same rules apply. At Normalize This, in this house, we know that trans women are women and trans men are men. Period. In the same way that it is unacceptable to ignore trans and non-binary people in conversations about reproductive rights, it is equally unacceptable to claim to be a part of the feminist movement and refuse to include trans and non-binary people in your cause. In this house, there is no room for TERFdom. Now, put a fork up me. I am done. Now, go embrace the taboo and get out of here. Bye.